All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome. We're into our Torah Motion series on Tanakh, putting put together of Tanakh, and we're up to translations, right? Part two, I believe, from Aramaic to Greek. So, Dr. Sokolov, bavakasha.
Indeed. Okay. So, good evening, everyone. We began our foray into translations last week, and we noted the Aramaic translation of the Torah that, according to tradition, was compiled or completed by a gentleman named Onkelos, and that its distinguishing characteristic is that, at least linguistically, it belongs to the Eastern or Babylonian branch of Aramaic, whereas other Targumim, some to the Torah, others to Nevi'im, or for that matter, as we'll see this evening, even to Ketuvim, are known variously as Palestinian Targumim, because linguistically they belong to the Western or Palestinian dialect of the Aramaic language. We also took note that the distinguishing characteristic of the Aramaic Targum of Onkelos is its rejection of anthropomorphism and its treatment of things in the Bible that would, if taken literally, be anthropomorphic, that is, that they would assign to God human bodily features, are treated as metaphors. What I'd like to do this evening, yes, and then when we looked at the so-called Jonathan Targums, that is, Targumim, other than the genuine Targum of Yonatan to Nevi'im, we took note of the fact that some of them are quite late, particularly the one that I showed you on Breshit 21:21, that clearly identified Yishmael with the prophet Mohammed by having him marry two of the women, by having him marry a woman who has the same name as one of the wives of Mohammed, and identifying another woman to whom he was married with the daughter of Mohammed. So I want to show you something similar this evening. And that, again, is from a Palestinian Targum to the Torah. And it is on B'midbar Kaf Dalet, which is part of the blessing that the Gentile prophet Bilaam conferred upon the Jewish people. And in one of the several visions of Bilaam that are recorded in this parasha, he speaks about Tzim. You may recognize it as the name of the Israeli maritime company, right? It's called Zim Lines, the word Tzim being borrowed from this very verse. It means a fleet of ships. So it speaks about a Tzim, a fleet of ships, that came from Kittim, the island of Kittim, usually identified with Crete. Ve'inu Ashur ve'inu Ever, and these people who will come by ship from Kittim will overcome both the Assyrians and the, I don't know, Hebrews, okay? And then eventually Gamhu, even these people from Kittim, Adei Oved, will themselves be destroyed. Okay, now this is clearly supposed to be a prophetic statement, because it's attributed to somebody who the Torah acknowledges was able to converse with God and was imbued with the spirit of prophecy. But just how prophetic it is exaggerated by the Aramaic Targum. We can forego the dubious pleasure of reading it in Aramaic and just look at the English translation. It says that ships, or quite literally sails or sailing vessels, armed for war, will come forth with great armies from Lombardia. Okay, it's a province in Italy. And it says, in fact, Umeara Italia, from the land of Italy. The Itztarfun, and these forces that will come from the province of Lombardy in Italy, will join with legions that will themselves come from Rome and Constantinople. Now, Rome was already Rome in the time of the sages of the Mishnah and the Talmud. Okay, but Constantinople doesn't come into existence until there was a king named Constantine in the 4th century. So clearly, this is at least as late as the 4th century. Okay, and this fleet, this army that will come from Italy and will consist of Lombardians and Romans and Constantinopolitans, okay, will afflict the Assyrians and will take the sons of Aver into captivity. Okay, could be somehow an allusion to the Roman conquest of Judea, destruction of the Second Temple, and the exile of Jews to Rome. Okay. Nevertheless, at the end of time, these and those, right, all of the armies are going to fall by the hand of Malko Mashiach. They will all be defeated by the Mashiach and will be brought to everlasting destruction. So once again, we get the idea that unlike the Targum of Onkelos, which although it isn't literal, at least sticks as much as possible to the literal sense of the text. Okay, the Palestinian Targumim, or the so-called Yonatan Targumim, have a tendency to indulge in some midrashic or agadic fancy. The Talmud talks about the Targum, Tanur Rabbanan, the Torah, right, when it comes to the public reading of the Torah, Echad Kore veEchad Mitargem. I spoke about this last week, a custom that survived pretty much only amongst a small number of Yemenite congregations where the public reading of the Torah on Shabbat is accompanied verse by verse with a public reading of the Targum of Onkelos. Ubilvad, but there's one reservation, Shelo Yehe Echad Kore Ushnayim Mitargemim, that there cannot be two people reciting the Targum simultaneously. There's a halachic principle that says Trei Kale La Mishtame, that two separate voices cannot be heard simultaneously. So we can get a sense of the importance that the rabbis attached to the Targum, to the Aramaic Targum of the Torah, that they wanted everybody to be able to hear it clearly. However, they say, well, Binavi, which would refer, I imagine, to those portions of the Nevi'im that are used as haftarot, there, Echad Kore Ushnayim Mitargumim. There they allow for two people to read the Targum, Bilvad with a different reservation, Shelo Yehu Shnayim Korim Ushnayim Mitargumim, that the biblical text itself cannot be read by two people simultaneously. And then it goes on and makes a third statement. It says, Ubahalel, when it comes to certain chapters of the book of Tehillim, Uve Megillah, arguably Megillat Esther, Afilu Asara Korin Vaasara Mitargamim. There, it can be a real public event. You can have everybody reciting the biblical text together and everybody reciting the Aramaic text together. Why? Aren't we concerned that people won't be able to hear it properly? So the Talmud says, no, don't worry, my Tama, why are we more lax in our treatment of Hallel and the Megillah? Kevan de Chaviva, that because these chapters of Hallel and Megillat Esther are particularly dear to people, Yahave da'ataihu, people will pay very close attention to it, Vishame, and therefore they will be able to hear both the biblical text and the Aramaic translation, even if it's being recited by several people at the same time. Now, the more curious thing here is that Rashi says, Asara Targumim, that the phrase that talks about an Aramaic Targum of chapters of Tehillim and of Megillat Esther, Rashi says, Lo Gar Sinan. Rashi says that he would basically delete that line from his text of the Talmud. Why would Rashi delete it? He says, Shein Tirgum Baktuvim. Because Rashi recalls the passage from the Talmud that we read last week, the one that told us that Onkelos translated the Torah, Yonatan translated the Nevi'im, but when Yonatan said, I would like to translate the Ketuvim as well, a voice came out from heaven and said, no way. Okay, that seemed to leave us with the impression that the Ketuvim were not translated into Aramaic. Therefore, Rashi would have us delete that third line from our Talmud texts. What's even more interesting is that the Tosafot, who were essentially Rashi's own students, said, Rashi mochek mitargimin, that Rashi deleted the line, lefisha'en mitargimin tirgum baktuvim, because there is no Aramaic version of the Ketuvim. And the Tosafot say, ulchinam mechako, that if indeed he deleted it, that was unnecessary. Why? Aval lo, I'm sorry, the vaday yesh targum, because of course there is an Aramaic version of Ketuvim. However, aval lo asa o Yehonatan, it's not as venerable as Yonatan's translation of the Nevi'im. Ela rather mimei hatanaim naasa. That unlike the Yonatan's translation of Nevi'im, which according to the Talmud was done early on in the Second Temple period, if you recall, it was done under the authority of the last three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, which would put it somewhere in the 6th century BCE, right? The Tosafot themselves acknowledge that whatever pass as the Aramaic Targumim of Ketuvim, of Tehillim, of Mishle, of the Megillot, etc., are from the time of the Tanaim, which would make them 600, 700, or even 800 years later. So there's already an acknowledgement here on the part of the Tosafot that some of the Aramaic Targumim that pass themselves off as being ancient and venerable are really, so to speak, Johnny-come-latelys. And here I just want to share with you a couple of passages from Aramaic Targumim to the Ketuvim. Here you have a passage from the very beginning, from the first verse of Shir HaShirim. Now, the verse itself in the biblical text simply says, Shir HaShirim Asher Lishlomo, right? That this is the choicest song of all of the songs of King Solomon. That's all it says. Look how the Targum expands on that. And it says, Shirin de Tushbachan, these are not merely songs, these are also words of praise. The Amar that were recited by Shlomo Neviah, Solomon the prophet, Malkadi Israel, king of Israel. So far, it's just a bit of an elaboration on the biblical text. Baruch Nevuat was done prophetically. Kadam Ribon Kol Olma, in the presence of the Lord of the universe, Hashem, God. Okay? So far, so good. Right? Heck of a lot more words in Aramaic than there were in Hebrew, but okay. But then, in the same breath, it continues and it says, Asarte Shiraso Is Amaru Ba'olma Hodein. 10 songs were sung in this world. Shiradein, this song, the one that's called Shir HaShirim, Mishubach Min Kulhon, is the best of all of them. And then it actually continues, and I will hopefully be able to share that with you. And then it continues, and it actually enumerates the 10 songs that were sung. Now, does it really mean that in all of biblical history, only 10 times did people sing? No. It's saying that in the biblical text, there are 10 passages in the biblical text that are specifically identified as being a shir or a shira, a poem or a song. And it enumerates them. Some are explicit in the text, others are inferred by the text, and yet others are just simply the product of the translator's imagination. So here are the 10 songs. The first song, he says, was spoken by Adam, Adam HaRishon. Under what condition, under what circumstances, when his guilt for having eaten of the tree of knowledge was forgiven, right? And according to the Talmud, this all transpired late on the afternoon of the first Friday. So eventually it became Shabbat, and Shabbat protected him from any further consequences of his actions, whereupon he sang a song. And what song was sung by Adam HaRishon? Mizmor Shir LiYom HaShabbat, right? Psalm 90, the one that we recite every Friday night and every Saturday morning. Okay. The second song was sung by Moses and the children of Israel at the time that God divided the sea before them. As it says, Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael et ha Shira Hazot LaShem. Okay. The third was the song sung by the children of Israel in the wilderness when they discovered a well with water. And it says that Az Yashir Yisrael et ha Shira Hazot, right? Ali Ve'er Enula. And so it also is introduced by the term Shir. The fourth song is the song that Moses recited on the eve of his departure from this world. That's the Shira of Ha'azinu Dvarim, chapter 32. The fifth song was sung by Yehoshua bin Nun on the occasion of the battle that he won in Giv'on, the one which he celebrated by reciting Shemesh b'Giv'on Dom v'Yareach b'Emek Ayalon. You may recall that when we looked through a medieval biblical commentary and we focused on the treatment of Midrash, we saw the commentary on this verse of Ralbag of Gersonides, who said that no, the sun didn't stand still and the moon didn't stand still, but rather it's a figure of speech that we, whose English equivalent would be time stood still. The sixth song was sung by Dvorah and Barak, and that song too is introduced in the fifth chapter of the book of Judges as a Shira, right? It's known as Shirat Devorah. The seventh song was sung by Hannah to celebrate the fact that God granted her a child, the prophet Shemuel. The eighth song was sung by King David. That would be 2 Samuel 22, the song that David sang celebrating all of the victories that God had miraculously given him. The ninth song is the one that we're talking about, Shir HaShirim. Okay, so what is the 10th song? It says the 10th song hasn't been sung yet. Shira saw Asire saw the 10th song. Asidin lememar Yosei will be recited in the future by Bnei Golvasa, by the Jews in the exile. On what occasion? Bi'idon di yifukun min golusa, when God takes them out of their exile. And what is that song? That song is one that is anticipated by the prophet Isaiah. We make reference to it at the Seder. It's the language of the verse is Hashir Yitchadesh Lachem Kaleil Chag, that the song of praise will be renewed as on the evening of the festival. And according to tradition, it's talking about the festival of Pesach, because the Talmud said B'Nisan Nigalu, that just as the first redemption of the Jewish people took place on the holiday of Pesach, B'Nisan Atidin Lehi Gael, the ultimate redemption of the Jewish people will also take place on the holiday of Pesach. So you can see this is a, clearly we would call it a midrashic elaboration on the opening verse of the book of Shir HaShirim, courtesy of an Aramaic translation. I might as well just go to the next one because I don't have to go back to the slides. Next week, we are going to take a break from the class in order to go and hear the reading of the Megillah. So I thought that I would share with you a passage from an Aramaic translation of Megillat Esther. And this isn't any old Aramaic translation of Megillat Esther. It's a particular Aramaic translation of Megillat Esther that even is entitled Tirgum Sheni, meaning it's not the standard Aramaic translation of Megillat Esther. It's an alternate Aramaic translation of Megillat Esther. And just like the one we saw a moment ago on Shir HaShirim, it is clearly midrashic in nature. Don't need to take up too much of the time, but let's just look at the beginning of it. Again, not going to read through the Aramaic. This is the Targum to not the first, not to the opening verse of Megillat Esther, but actually to the second verse. The one that says, Bayamim Haheim, during those days, that is during the reign of Ahasuerosh, right? Keshevet HaMelech Ahasuerosh al Kisei Malchuto, when King Ahasuerosh was seated on his royal throne, Asher B'Shushan HaBira, which is situated in the city of Shushan, or the fortress of Shushan, B'Shnat Shalosh L'Molcho, in the third year of his reign, Asam Mishtelecho Sarav Avadav, he threw a banquet and invited all of his servants and all of his officials, etc., etc. Targum says as follows. Of this, that is to say, referring specifically to the phrase that refers to Ahasuerosh as being seated on his royal throne. The Targum says, of this situation, a verse in the book of Daniel says that God deposes kings and installs them. Meaning, part of a midrashic tradition, that Ahasuerosh was not entitled to the throne. He was a usurper of the throne. There are alternate midrashic traditions about this. At the beginning of the world, the firstborn would receive sovereignty and glory. However, we find that once Cain killed his brother Abel, the world was not built up from either of them. Rather, it was built up from Sheth, right? From Seth, Sheth. Okay. Hevel was dead. Cain was banished. Okay. We don't hear any more about him or his descendants after the first chapter or so. Okay. Rather, the continuation of history all proceeds from Adam and Eve's third son, Sheth, to whom sovereignty and glory was granted. As Chava said when he was born, Shat Elohim li bein acher, God has given me another or an alternate child. Okay. Sheth then bequeathed the sovereignty and glory that he had received from Adam. He bequeathed it to his son Enosh, Enosh to his son Canaan, and so on and so forth until it reached Noah. Okay? Noah bequeathed sovereignty to his son Shem. Shem himself had five sons. Okay? He didn't bequeath the sovereignty to the firstborn or even to the secondborn, but rather to Arpachshad, who was Shem's third-born son. Now, you see a pattern emerging here? Not Cain, not Hevel, but Sheth, who was the third-born son. Not Yefet, not Ham, but Shem, who was the third-born son, right? Not Arpachshad, Elam, not Ashur, but Arpachshad, the third-born son of Shem. Okay? There's a pattern emerging here. Okay? Arpachshad received the sovereignty. Why? Why did Shem skip his firstborn and secondborn? Because he wanted sovereignty to go to Arpachshad because Abraham was destined to be descended from him. Abraham then bequeathed sovereignty and glory to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to Judah, Judah to Peretz, Peretz to Chetzron, and it continues in the genealogical line of Yehuda until it finally reaches King David, and from King David it goes to Solomon, and from Solomon through the Judean monarchic line until it finally gets to Tzidkiyahu, who was the last of the kings of the First Temple period. Now, when Tzidkiyahu was exiled to Babylonia, that the sovereignty and glory passed from him. So to whom did it go next? Nebuchadnezzar assumed sovereignty and glory because he conquered Tzidkiyahu. Okay? God pondered this and said, all the time that dominion or sovereignty was left in the hands of my sons, it would rotate among them, meaning one was wicked, another was righteous. One would borrow, another would repay. Now, however, that dominion has been taken from my sons, right, and passed to Nebuchadnezzar, it should be restored to whom? Think back. Who should have gotten it but was passed over? Another allusion to forthcoming holiday, right? Remember, Shame did not give the sovereignty to his firstborn son, Elam, or even to his secondborn son, Ashur, but only to his thirdborn son, Arpachshad, and that was only on account of Abraham. But now that Abraham or Abraham's descendants have lost their right to the sovereignty, to whom should it revert? It should revert to the firstborn son of Shem, the one who was passed over. Therefore, God says, now the dominion has been taken from my sons, it should be restored to the people of Elam, the grandson of Shem. It was on account of Israel that it was given to Arpachshad in the first place, but now that Israel has sinned, it should revert to Elam. I see there's a typo here, to wit, right? And the citation of a verse in the book of Daniel and another in the book of Jeremiah, and that's how Ahasuerus came to be a king. Ahasuerus came to be a king because he was a king of Persia, and Persia is in the line of Elam, and Elam finally got the sovereignty that it might have received from Shem millennia before, but it was passed over on account of the people of Israel. So, as I said here again, you can see this isn't just an interpolation of a little agadic passage here and there. There's a whole philosophy of history behind this. Okay. And with that, we can move ourselves along. And I leave you with one last thought before we move from the Aramaic translations. This is a statement attributed to the Tana, Rabbi Yehuda, arguably Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai, one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, would make it mid to late second century of the Common Era. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Hametargem Pasuk Kitzurato, someone who translates a verse literally, Tzurato means whatever meets the eye. Okay? And what meets the eye is arguably the literal sense of a word. Because after all, the word literal means the letters as it's spelled out. Okay? So Rabbi Yehuda says that someone who thinks that you can translate every verse literally, Hare Zebadai, that's a charlatan. That's somebody who doesn't know what translation is all about, simply because no two languages are that close to each other that you can replace the same word in one language with the same word in the other language all the time. Okay? So first Rabbi Yehuda says, you can't translate everything literally. Now tell me, if you're not going to translate literally, what's the alternative? The alternative is that sometimes you're going to translate things figuratively. If you translate something figuratively, it means that in your translation, there are bound to be words or expressions that aren't literally in the original text. Problem is that Rabbi Yehuda continues and he says, v'hamosif alav, that anybody who in his translation adds to the literal sense, That's even worse. He's not just a charlatan. Hareza mecharef umegadef. That's somebody who is guilty of cursing and blaspheming. I pose this here simply in order to sensitize us to the essential mystery or conundrum of translation. As I said, Rabbi Yehuda's initial premise is one that we can all take to. I'm sure you've noticed over the time that you've seen my or anybody else's sources that wherever they're lined up with the Hebrew on one side of the page and the English on the other, the English is always noticeably, even significantly longer than the Hebrew. Okay? So we know that no two languages are that alike that you can substitute the same word in one for the same word in the other all the time and still make sense. Okay? That makes translation a very difficult task indeed, particularly if you're translating from one family of languages to another. Arguably, Aramaic and Hebrew are very alike. They're sister languages. So at least the sentence structure is the same, right? Nouns and verbs and the different ways in which verbs are conjugated and the ways in which nouns decline, right? They're alike, okay? But once you move out of the family of Semitic languages, the same will go for Arabic. We're going to talk the next time we meet, we're going to talk about the Arabic translation of the Torah that was done in the 10th century by Saadia Gaon. So just as Aramaic and Hebrew are sister languages, so are Arabic and Hebrew. So arguably, an Aramaic translation of the Torah and an Arabic translation of the Torah can hew pretty closely to the originals. But once you're going to translate into a language that's from a completely different family, Greek, as we're going to look at it in a moment, or into English, right? How do you walk this fine line that Rabbi Yehuda has set up here, where on the one hand, you can't treat everything literally, but on the other hand, neither should you be adding to it? Now, Rashi, as you see, that's the little print there, already realized that this is a very difficult thing to do. And therefore, Rashi gives an interpretation of what he thinks Rabbi Yehuda meant. And he says, on the second line of the Rashi, I, onkelos, meaning all you have to do is look at the Aramaic translation of onkelos, the ones that the rabbis called Targum Dilan, our Targum, the ones that they elevated to the position where it was read on Shabbat alongside the Torah in the synagogue. And you'll see that the translation of onkelos adds things to it. We saw an example last week. So how could onkelos add things to the literal sense without violating Rabbi Yehuda's prohibition? Ah, says Rashi, the onkelos kishehose, that the additions that you will find in the Targum of onkelos, Lomidato Hosif. They're not things that were original to onkelos. Onkelos did not say, I know how to do it. Rather, Hare Bisinainitam. That's part of the tradition we saw reflected in the Targum in the Talmud last week that attributed an Aramaic translation of the Torah back to the days of Nehemiah. According to this tradition, wherever onkelos strays from the literal sense of the Torah, he's doing so based on a rabbinic tradition. And all rabbinic traditions originate in Mount Sinai, even if, as Rashi says, shenishtakach v'chazar v'yiseid, even if the tradition was forgotten for a period of time, and then subsequently reinstated. And that's how Rashi accounts for the many times that the Targum of onkelos, let alone the Aramaic Targumim called Yonatan, that we've looked at this evening, how they can get away with adding so many things to the literal sense of the verse. And that, of course, takes us to the Septuagint. Okay, in parentheses, LXX, which is, of course, the Roman numerals for the number 70, and that's a frequent academic substitute for the rather lengthy word Septuagint. So instead of having to write out Septuagint, simply use LXX. This is a passage we looked at last week, the one in which Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that Sefarim, books of Tanakh, lo hitiru sheyikatavu ela yevanit, that the only translation that the rabbis allowed was into Greek. Why into Greek? Skip down to the bottom. Hainu tama, the reason is as follows. Dichtiv, because it's based on the interpretation of a Torah verse. According to the Torah, Noah blessed his son Yefet by saying, Yaft Elohim li Yefet. God will recognize Yefet's beauty. V'yishkon be'ahole shem. And either Yefet himself or arguably the beauty of Yefet will take up residence in the tents of shame. Now you all remember, when the Torah says about our father Jacob, that is, he was a Yoshev Ohalim, how did the rabbis understand that? They didn't understand it literally as a tent dweller, which is probably what it means, because we know from the Torah that shepherds lived in tents, and Yaakov, as we know, was a shepherd, right? But the rabbis understood it, they understood the Ohel to be an icon, if you wish, for what we call a Beit Midrash, a place of Torah study. Therefore, if the verse says that the beauty of Yefet can take up residence in the Ohel of Shem, it means that there's some place at which Greek and Torah can meet. And they interpreted it to mean Yaf yuto shel Yefet, that the beauty of Yefet, Yehe ba'ahole shem, can take up residence in even in the tents of Torah. And those are the grounds on which they permitted the Torah to be translated into Greek. Now, of course, you can ask, wait a second, on what grounds did they permit the Torah to be translated into Aramaic? There is no such parallel passage. Rather, I imagine it's simply a matter of common sense. Whole chapters of the Bible are in Aramaic, books of Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah. So whole chapters of the Bible are already in Aramaic, then obviously Aramaic is already a holy language, right? If we call the Tanakh Kitvei Kodesh, and Aramaic is part of Kitvei Kodesh, then Aramaic already has been acknowledged as, to some extent, the equivalent of Hebrew. There is even Aramaic in the Torah itself, right? The rabbis even at one point even point to it, right? When Yaakov and Lavan make a peace treaty between themselves, Yaakov, if you recall, calls the monument to the peace treaty Gal Eid, right? The cairn of testimony. But Lavan named it in Aramaic, right? Yegor Sohadusa. So if there are Aramaic words in the Torah and there were whole Aramaic chapters in the Ketuvim, then, as I said, you don't really need another excuse, as it were, to admit Greek. I'm sorry, to admit Aramaic. Hence, when it came to Greek, they needed some justification for it. There are two principal accounts of the origin of the Jewish translation of the Torah into Greek. One is called the Letter of Aristeas. It's a Hellenistic Jewish work from the second century. And echoes of this work, which is part of the pseudepigrapha, can be found in both the work of Philo, right? And the works of Josephus. So apparently it was current amongst Jews who lived in or were under the influence of Hellenistic culture. Okay? That story in the letter of Aristeas informs us that a Greek king who was assumed to be Ptolemy II, Ptolemy Philadelphus, placing it, as you see, in the 3rd century BCE, discovered that his library in Alexandria, you must have heard of it, right, lacked a copy of the Torah. Whereupon he had his librarian contact the high priest in Jerusalem, right? This is the 3rd century BCE. There is still a temple in Jerusalem. And the high priest dispatched 72 scholars, 6 from each of the 12 tribes, who sat together on the island of Pharos outside Alexandria. That's the site of the fabled lighthouse of Alexandria, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. And they sat there for 72 days. And in those 72 days, these 72 Jews completed the Greek translation of the Torah. We have a different version of this in the Talmud itself. Some of it is the same, namely that it was a king Ptolemy, and that it was translated into Greek, and it was translated by 72 Jewish elders or scholars. But there are some different details. Instead of they're all sitting together to do it, the king deliberately puts them into 72 different rooms. And yet, miraculously, each of them produces the identical translation, even though in their translations, they each saw to change some things in the literal Hebrew text. Okay. A third version of this story is from the Middle Ages. It's called Masechet Sofrim, but it's not part of the Talmud. It's actually a work from the Gaonic era. But as you see from the title Sofrim, it's distinguished because it deals with texts. Okay, same thing, except here are some of the details. Again, it's a Greek king named Ptolemy, but here it's only 5 elders, maybe 1 for each of the books of the Torah. Okay. And again, another version of it that there were 72 elders. Okay. The basic difference, the most significant difference, is that according to the version in the letter of Aristeas, the rabbis endorsed the Greek translation, while according to the Talmudic and Midrashic sources, the rabbis viewed the Greek translation with disapproval. In fact, later Jewish tradition even assigned a day of public fasting in commemoration of the Greek translation of the Torah. And I quote to you, not from the Babylonian Talmud, but from the Shulchan Aruch. Bishmona b'Tevet, on the 8th day of the month of Tevet, nichtava ha-Torah yevanit b'nei Talmai ha-Melech, the Torah was translated into Greek during the days of King Ptolemy. Vayachoshech ba'olam shlosha yamim. And it's Gevor in Finster, right? All of a sudden, the world was darkened for 3 days. Clearly, they were not enamored of this translation. The emendations that the translators included are recorded in Tanaitic literature, in the Mechilta to Shmot, in Amoraic literature, in the Babylonian Talmud, and the Palestinian Talmud in Masechet Megillah. And for the most part, these alterations to the literal text of the Torah that the Greek translators made are in order to preclude potential theological problems. For example, in the second chapter of Genesis, God says, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmuteinu. Let us make a mortal in our image. To whom is he speaking? In the plural. Let us in our image. Right? Now, of course, we can answer that, right? We are comfortable with something that we call the plural of majesty, right? Kings, for some reason, get away with talking about themselves in the plural, right? So God, the King of Kings, right, can say, Na'aseh, let us, when he's only referring to himself. But in order simply not to have this cause problems, according to the Talmud, the Greek translators, or the translators of the Torah into Greek, translated the verse as though it said, E'eseh Adam b'tselem u'bidmut. Let me fashion a mortal in my image, so to speak, eliminating the problem altogether. A slightly more subtle or sophisticated problem arises later when it describes God as Vayachal Elohim Bayom Hashivi'i Melachto Asher Asa Vayishbot Bayom Hashivi'i Mikol Melachto Asher Asa. That God rested on the seventh day, I understand, that's Shabbos. But did he work on Shabbos? No. But wait a second. It says, Vayachal Elohim Bayom Hashivi'i Melachto Asher Asa. On the seventh day, God finished his work. Now, again, we have ways of interpreting that. Ibn Ezra, for example, says, Kilui Melacha Einenu Melacha. Cessation from work is not in itself work. It's the absence of work. But again, simply to eliminate problems, lest the Gentiles say, ha-ha, why do you observe Shabbos? Your God worked on Saturday. It says so in your own Torah, right? They translated the verse as though it said, Vayichal Elohim Bayom HaShishi, Vayishbot Bayom HaShivi'i. So these are at least the explanations that are given by the Talmud to what it stipulates as the changes that the 72 translators made in the Torah. What does the Septuagint actually say? Where does it differ from the Masoretic text? I brought just a couple of quick examples. Here again, sticking to the beginning of the Torah, when God tells Adam and Eve what will be the consequences of their actions in eating from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, God says to the woman, Harba arbe itzvonech veheronech, that I'm going to greatly multiply your labor pains. Be'etzev tel divanim, that childbirth will be painful. Ve'el ishech teshukatech, right? Your desire will be focused on your husband. V'hu yimshol bach. And he, as a consequence of that, will rule over you. Okay. Notice, here's a rendition, a retro version, if you wish. It's a translation of the Greek translation of the Hebrew back into English. And to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pains and your groanings. In pain you will bring forth children. So far, so good. But then notice that he translates the word teshukatech, not as your desire, but your submission. You will submit to your husband and he will rule over you. Now, two interesting things about this. One is that the assumption on the part of scholars is that this is not a mistake in the sense that they didn't know what the word teshukah meant, but rather it's an indication that the Hebrew text they were translating was itself different from ours. And that instead of saying teshukatech, it said teshuvatech. Your submission, your return, your giving yourself over to. The other thing that's just a curiosity is the Greek word for submission, for return, which I don't know how good you are at reading Greek, but at the bottom left-hand corner, it actually is apostrophe. I just thought that was an interesting thing because it's a word we use commonly in English and maybe have never actually looked up in a dictionary. But we use an apostrophe to set off something. Hence the idea, apostrophe, the idea of turning to or turning from. Another example, again, from the beginning of Bereshit, we have the address that a character named Lemech makes to his two wives, Ada and Tzila. He says, Ki ish haragti lefitzei v'yeled lechaburati. He claims to have killed somebody, according to the Agadic tradition. He killed no lesser figure than Cain. Okay? But he's worried about the consequences of his actions. And he says, Kishivatayim yukam Cain. If Cain was avenged sevenfold, then just imagine what fate lies in store for me as the person who killed Cain. V'lemech, that's him, Shivim v'shiva'a. Now here's the big question of what do you understand Shivim v'shiva to mean? Literally, Shivim v'shiva means 77. Right? So he could be saying that if Cain was avenged seven times, then Lemech will be avenged 77 times. Nice way to preserve the idea of seven. I even brought you a verse on the bottom, right, which tells us about this character named Lemech. Most interesting thing. You see how many years he lived? He lived Sheva v'shiva'im shana u'shva me'ot shana. Lemech, who talks about Cain sevenfold and Lemech 77, lived 777 years. So obviously, there's something there between Lemech and the number seven. But the curious thing is, you see, first of all, that the English translation doesn't render Shivim b'Shiva as 77. It renders it as 70 times seven. 77-fold. And then here it seems to be following in the tradition that's also reflected in the Septuagint, with the difference, however, that in English understands the word you come as being the future tense, while the Septuagint understands it as being the past tense. But you got to admit that this proliferation of sevens got to mean something. And the final example, okay, again, beginning of Bereshit, it tells us that Adam lived shloshim u'ma'at shana, that at the age of 130, vayoled bidmuto kitzalmo. He had another child, and this was Shet. We spoke about him just a few minutes ago. So how old was Adam when Shet was born? 130. That's what it says in the English. For some reason, in the Septuagint, the 100 became 200. Now, is it again because they had a different Hebrew text? Could their Hebrew text have had a mem at the end of the word ma'at, so that it could be read as matayim? Or maybe it's only because it doesn't say shloshim shana ume'a shana. Maybe just the fact that the word is ma'at rather than me'a was interpreted by them to mean, it doesn't just mean a single hundred, it means a pair of hundreds. I don't know. But I do know that if we follow the Septuagint's chronology in the opening chapters of the book of Genesis, a strange thing happens. And you see it in the Hebrew. It's a passage I took out of a book. It's a scholarly study of the Septuagint to the book of Genesis. It says, Lefi rov kitfei hayad shel tirgum hashivim. If we follow, as I say, the chronology, based upon the majority of manuscripts that we have of the Septuagint, it turns out that Methuselah, right, the guy who lived longer than anybody else, 969 years, he died in the year 2256 to the creation of the world. Meaning if you add up the lives of Adam until Shet was born, and Shet until Enosh was born, and Enosh until everybody was born, then it turns out that Methuselah lives until the year 2256 from creation. But there's a problem. Problem is that according to biblical chronology, the flood was in the year 2242 to creation. In which case, according to the Septuagint chronology, Metushelah lived through the flood and 14 years after the flood without having survived by entering the Teva of Noah like Noah and his sons. So on one hand, you'd say, oh, then clearly the Septuagint, we see here they got one, they made a mistake, 200 instead of 100. That's all you need. Deduct 100 from the chronology and Methuselah dies before the flood. But if we take a look at it through a midrashic lens, I remind you that according to the midrash, there was at least one other character who survived the flood without having been a passenger on Noah's ark. And that, if you may recall, was Og, king of the Bashan, who according to the Talmud was tall enough that he was actually able to survive the flood because the waters never got up past his chin. So if Noah could, if Og could survive the flood without having to be a passenger in Noah's ark, maybe Methuselah could have survived it as well. Last thing I want to point out is that in the third century of the Common Era, a Christian scholar named Origen, who came from Alexandria, again, the center of Hellenistic culture, put together a book that was called the Hexapla, hexa being Greek for six, which consists of the Hebrew text of the Bible, its transliteration into Greek, and then the remaining four columns were the four principal Greek versions of the Septuagint. And here you can see a model of the Hexapla, and that basically has been the basis for all academic and scholarly work on the Septuagint for the past, you know, since biblical scholarship emerged. And that, as I said, brings us to the end of this evening. Let me take a look here at the there actually are passages in Targumim that are actually as late as the Crusades also. I just chose one that's somewhat earlier, but there are older ones. Miriam's song, it's not only a repeat of her brothers here, it's a repeat of her brothers in the Torah. So what can you do about it? The Greek of the Tanakh is classical Greek. Classical Greek, not demotic, nothing to do with that. Present generations don't know when to use an apostrophe. That's good. I like that one. Okay. Hexapla, H-E-X-A-P-L-A, Hexapla, six columns. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. I might be missing something, but I don't get how in the world Metushelah was born in the year 2246 or 56, whatever it said.
No, died. That's when he died.
No, how? Why would that be? He was born. He died in 1056, because just add up. Go in Bereshit and add up all the years, and then I'll do it again.
No. I'm saying again. The problem. Say if you follow the Septuagint chronology.
Okay, so that means a whole bunch of them are off, not just.
That's what I said. Right. Not just the one. Not just the one about Adam being 230.
Right. Right. All the generations, they've got to be. Okay, because according to, just the Psukim in Bereshit, he dies in 1056, and the flood is that year. And of course, Abraham was born in 1948. Of course, that's the, you know, for all the Zionists out there. That's always a cute one, right? Okay. Anyways, okay. Thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks, 2 weeks time. Next week, everybody enjoy the Megillah in Hebrew and English. You didn't get into the discussion, right? Theoretically, we can read the Megillah in French, English, whatever language you'd like. But of course, in practice, we don't do things like that. Anyways, okay. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Of course, Shuli Mishkan at 12 o'clock. We've had a a slight, just a switch of a couple of weeks for the Parsha Shir tomorrow night. The Kamei Jacobowitz, who was supposed to give it in a few weeks, is actually going to give it tomorrow night because Rabbi Robinson can't make it and whatever. So tomorrow night's Parsha Shir will be given by Tammy Jacobowitz, who also from Teaneck. And so that's at 8:30 tomorrow night. We invite everybody. She's very good. And then Friday morning, of course, my Shir on the Seder at 9 a.m. And then Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag begins. Pretty soon we're just finalizing details. We hope to have in the next couple of days our sort of our pre-Pesach program. I have a number of, I think, interesting classes before leading up to Pesach. And, okay, we look forward to seeing everybody. Invite a friend, please. And,
Jay.
Yes.
Next week, when we're off from Israel for an hour, we're staying on Eastern time.
Oh, when is Israel changing the clock? I don't know about this.
Not this week. I think in 2 weeks.
Oh, we change it this week. Oh, you know what? I thank you for reminding me. Right. Of course, Israel won't change it. Right? We change this Saturday night. So I will have to speak to the Israeli speakers.
Alex Israel said yesterday that he's staying on Eastern time.
Right. So surely, in other words, we'll be an hour ahead, right? We'll be 6 hours. My guess is the reason Shuli's class is at 12 and not at 11 is just because of her schedule. She didn't want to do it at 11 in case she wasn't home by 6. So my guess is either for 1 week or 2 weeks it would change, she won't mind, or we'll have to move her class till 1 o'clock. That's actually a very good point, and
well,
next
week is Purim anyhow. I don't think she's giving
right. The class there is no class next week either, so it's in 2 weeks. Anybody know when they change the clock in Israel? Maybe tomorrow we'll find. Okay, I'll have to find out when they change the clock in Israel. See, right. Of course, there's no class next Thursday. There will be a Parshat HaShavua class next Thursday night, given by yours truly. I'm not mean enough to ask anybody else to give it because, you know, I mean, people may be who knows what, but I don't want to cancel it. It's after Purim. So next Thursday night, I will have the pleasure.
They change the clock in Israel at the end of March.
Oh, so fine. So at most we're talking 1 week. Okay, fine. We'll work that out. Thank you for bringing that up, Rabbi Avner. Thank you. And like I said, so next Thursday night, I'll give the Parsha Shir. So I hope you'll still come, but, and so it'll be after Purim already, 8:30 at night. But, okay. But yes, the Wednesday night, of course, Dr. Sokolow and Thursday morning, Shuli Wednesday night, Thursday will be, you know, canceled for the week because of Purim. But as the Gemara in Megillah says, Mevatlim Talmud Torah LeKriyat HaMegillah. That's the whole topic, the whole sugya. When, you know, you cancel Torah study is the beginning of Masechet Megillah, where the Gemara says, Mevatlim Talmud Torah LeKriyat HaMegillah. You nullify the reading of Torah for the learning of Torah for Megillah. This whole interesting discussion, what that means exactly, and isn't the Megillah also learning Torah, but whatever. So that's what we'll do. We will be Mevatel Talmud Torah for Kriyat HaMegillah next Wednesday night and Thursday, and hopefully everybody will read the Megillah and learn the Megillah properly. And of course, Aaron Kohler's class this Tuesday, finishing up his 6-part series on Mikra Megillah. It's a fascinating series. Okay, I think we've spoken up. Anybody has any other questions, comments, or suggestions, always willing to hear. Like I say, by the way, we always are looking for, ideas and suggestions, speakers, etc., and a number of them we have taken up on people. So always feel free. Always want to hear your comments. Yes, Canada changes when the U.S. does. Yes, in that sense, we are. I wouldn't say we're an American colony, thank God, but I would say that yes, we do change the clock at the same time as America does. I think Saskatchewan. Anybody ever been there? I've never been to Saskatchewan, but Regina, Saskatchewan does not change the clock. I think there's one or two states in the U.S. also that don't change the clock. They want to remain on Eastern Standard Time. I know Saskatchewan is Mountain Time, I think, but whatever. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov, invite your friends. We look forward to learning with you in the near future. Okay, have a good night.
Thank you. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
Apostrophe. Is the apostrophe that you're talking about, Rabbi Sokolow, is that the same apostrophe as the apostrophe that's possessive, possibly? We use an apostrophe to indicate possession. So could the Septuagint have indicated possession?
That would require a classicist rather than a biblicist, but it certainly sounds logical to me.
Okay. I think it is correct. People today don't know how to use apostrophes, myself included, occasionally. When does apostrophe go? After the letter, you know, before, like, you know, after whatever. Right, when it's possessive and not possessive. Okay, we need a little bit of English grammar. Okay. If anybody knows, feel free to speak up. Okay, Lailatov.
Yes.